Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA, the voice of the community, reminding you support for WEAA is provided by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at Bray and Scarf. And on our way to our conversation here about the future of journalism, we will start with our day in history, August the 9th, and who on this day was born in 1905, Robert C. Nix, who was the first African-American congressman from Pennsylvania, an 11-term congressman. He was actually one of the African-American politicians who led the way back into the way to the Democratic Party in 1932 when he worked for Roosevelt. This is the birthday of Sam Elliott, born in 1944. Curtis Blow was born on this day in 1959, and we'll be hearing her songs all during the course of the next 2 hours during our breaks. This is the birthday in 1963 of Whitney Houston, who left us much too early in 2012. And Deion Sanders, the man who inspired so many young people playing both baseball
Neon
and football.
Deion.
Yes, that's it. Deion. And also this is a day that in terms of deaths, Edith Stein, who was born a Jew, became a nun, and fought against the Nazis, was executed on this day in 1942 as now St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. This is the day that Hermann Hesse died, Nobel laureate, who wrote a book that affected a lot of people, Siddhartha, and many other books that he wrote. This is also the death of Dmitri Shostakovich in 1975, and Cannonball Adderley, only 46 years old, died on this day as well, as did Gregory Hines, much too young, and Bernie Mac, much too young, and a great poet who we had the opportunity to interview here in this program twice over the last 20 years, Mahmoud Darwish, one of the great Palestinian poets. This was a day in 1848. The Free Soil Party was organized to fight the spread of slavery in America. This is the day that Henry David Thoreau published Walden, another seminal work that affected a lot of people in their thinking, in 1854. The beginning of the end of the right of the Nez Perce people to live on their land started on this day with the Battle of Big Hole in 1877 when they clashed with the army, and this led to the demise of their right to stay on their own land. They're still fighting to get back. The Nez Perce today are in the news. We'll be talking about later in this program because they are fighting the pollution of their land, and we will be talking about that later in the broadcast in the next hour. This is the day that Betty Boop made her debut in the cartoons, and Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals in the Berlin Olympics today in 1936. This was also the day in 1945 that Nagasaki was hit by the atomic bomb that the Americans affectionately called Fat Man, and 39,000 people were killed instantly when that bomb was dropped. This is the day in 1969 that Charles Manson murdered Sharon Tate, Abigail Folger, and others in a day that stands out in American history. This is the day that President Nixon resigned from office after Watergate in 1974. And this is the day the indigenous people are at the UN today demanding rights for the earth, social justice for all human beings. On this day that in 1995, August 9th, was declared the International Day of World Indigenous Peoples Day. So that's this day in history, August the 9th. And now we turn to our program. We are going to talk about the future of journalism because we've seen all of the stories in the press with Bezos buying the Washington Post, John Henry buying the Boston Globe, and many people, as I said earlier, being concerned about the future of journalism and concerned about what it means that single billionaires are taking over newspapers. Does it mean the further demise of newspapers and journalism in our country? We are joined by Dr. Robert McChesney. Bob McChesney is author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism Has Turned the Internet Against Democracy. He's professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, founder of the Free Press. And on Tuesday, September 17th, Bob McChesney and John Nichols will be here in Baltimore talking about their new book, Dollarocracy, at the 2640 space at 7:30 p.m. that I'll be moderating with them. We're joined in the studio here by Karen Hoopert, author of Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, assistant professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, and Charles Robinson, political commentator, reporter for MPT, with new stories coming out on MPT soon on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington on economic development in Western Maryland. Welcome to the four of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on our Facebook pages. Your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Bob, let me start you and we'll go around the room just about what, you know, when we've been following kind of the demise of the press here in America, people being laid off. We're going to hear a short clip from David Simon shortly in this program and his comments that he was going to join us today, but he's on holiday and couldn't make this panel. But given everything that's been going on in the press, why are people getting so worked up about the latest purchases of the Post and the Globe?
Well, I think the reason is that there are two things. One is the reason I don't think a lot of people are really still wrapped their heads around, which is that what this signals first and foremost is the death of commercial journalism. I mean, the fact that the Post sold for maybe 1/10, 1/50th of some absurdly small percentage of what it was worth just a decade ago, I think it's an indication that Wall Street and Madison Avenue both have jumped ship on commercial journalism as a credible undertaking, at least in anything close to what we assumed was the natural order of things in the 20th century. And so I think that is daunting to people who think of it in those terms. The other side of the coin is that as the prices have plummeted, the value in owning these monopoly franchise newspapers now, like the Washington Post or the Globe or the Chicago Tribune, on and on, all the great daily newspapers in American history, is not that they're going to generate profits for the owners, because even at these low prices, there's no one who can figure out how to make money. In fact, the whole hedge fund community bought up about half of the leading daily newspapers in the last 5 years, and most of them have sold them off. They've given up. They've realized you can't even strip these things for parts at this point. Instead, what we have is that we're going back to sort of the battle days of the values in their political muscle, that they still have tremendous influence over the politics of a community and a nation. So if you own the Washington Post, or if you own the Boston Globe, or the LA Times, or the Wall Street Journal, which actually, let's leave that aside, if you own one of these major dailies, you can shape the political debate. You can shape what's talked about and what isn't talked about. And if you've got strong political interests, and many billionaires do because their financial stakes are tied up with crucial political interests, this can give you an immense amount of power. And I think that's what's most daunting and frightening about the period we're entering, because there's not much competition. There's no one else is doing much journalism. So you're pretty much, you own the board now when you pay a relatively small amount of money to buy one of these papers.
Ship, and then we'll go around the table just for opening the comments. Then we'll have a lot of people calling in. We'll get to those phone calls in just a second. Ship.
I concur with this sense of angst about the future of commercial journalism, as you put it. But it's also kind of exciting because at least so far, some of these new owners are saying the right things, that they want to see these publications thrive. So for the time being, I want to hold them at their word and just be vigilant to see if that is indeed the case. It's not unusual to have rich people owning media. So the fact that billionaires are buying these newspapers doesn't in and of itself frighten me in any way. I do want to see, though, whether they live up to what they're currently saying they want to do, which sounds like they will leave hands off the news. They may shape editorial page policy, but they claim so far, or seem to be saying, hands off the news.
Karen?
Well, I actually think this sounds in some ways like a positive move, because one of the things that I think is interesting, well, first I'll offer a little disclaimer that I write for the Washington Post magazine from time to time as a freelancer. But I think as a reporter, it's really an acknowledgement in some ways that the problem isn't the material or the content, but the delivery system and the business model. So I think that I'm going to look at, the purchase of the Washington Post and all of the background that Bezos brings to, from Amazon to this industry. I'm actually feeling a little bit optimistic about what he might do to change the way people get the news, consume the news, and use that money or those profits to actually maintain and build back the Washington Post, which has lost so many employees. It used to be 1,000 in 2012, and it's about 640 now. Colleagues of mine at the Post have talked about, like, kind of rattling around in this empty building with these, you know, desks and empty cubicles everywhere. So I think, you know, the fact that he has the money, that he seems to be in this for the long term, and isn't in a rush to make an immediate profit, might actually mean that he is able to find a way to make money in journalism, and then that, you know, then we'll really have a robust newspaper there again.
Okay, I'm going to take that opposing viewpoint, if you will, because, look, our business is always about change. Media is about change. It's not about standing still. You know, the moment you stand still, you die. Because that's how media works. It has always worked that way. The other part of this is that, look, the demographics associated with newspaper readership, whether you like it or not, is aging. And it is getting older. It is not getting younger. To give you an example, I meet with 20 and 30-year-olds, and let me tell you, none of them are reading a newspaper. Whether you like it or not, they're never going to read a newspaper unless it's something that kind of goes, I think I might want to hold on to this, because it might become a collector's edition. Trust me, in the last 5 years, the two most sold-out newspapers were when Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination, the day he was inaugurated, and the second go-round. Most people bought those papers because they thought they were going to be, quote, heirlooms. Think of it as the Dewey Beats Truman model, if you will. Everybody who had a copy of that paper seemed to, you know, make a little bit of extra money on it. So let's move forward on what our evolution is, because that's what this is about. It's the evolution of how we do what we do. You know, I've written about this many, many years ago, said the journalists of the future will not come from journalism. We already see that, where we have lawyers pontificating as if they're journalists. And take any other in sundry, if you will, professions, from the medical field to engineering. These people think they can do what I do. Well, I beg to differ with them. Now, let's talk a little bit about why they're buying them. First of all, you guys don't realize nobody was buying newspapers the last 4 years. They couldn't find a buyer. So the fact that somebody wants to buy a newspaper, in my opinion, means that they have not only value, but they have long-term value. What will they do with these properties? I don't know, but I can tell you it's never, ever good for journalists, whether you like it or not. Let me just tell you, somebody's going to lose a job. And that means that journalists must transition to a new phase in their lives. And, you know, look, you got to teach an old dog new tricks, because that's how this business works. Because if you don't learn new tricks, right, you're going to be lost.
So let me kind of pull back in some of the things we just said here and get to the phones. Both Jeff's and Bruce, we're going to come to your calls in just a minute. But I want to kind of push something out, because, Bob, I want you to jump back in. One of the things that to kind of wrestle with this divide we have in this discussion right now over whether we're seeing a transition to a digital age and newspapers just have to fail because they do not have the economic model that meets the 21st century. How does that mix with where you see the world of capitalism today and what that means for journalism? You've written some things about the turn of the century being clear, the turn of the century being 19th to 20th and newspapers. So in terms of what you just heard, bring that analysis to the table so we can wrestle with that before we open the phones.
Sure thing, Mark. I would say from my research that, you know, we talk about newspapers and their decline and old media and their decline, but in fact, no one's figured out how to make money doing journalism on the Internet either. It's not like there's huge newsrooms that are replacing old media newsrooms. It was striking that Rupert Murdoch, who certainly is probably the most visionary person in the corporate media community and has the longest time horizon, he tried to start an iPad daily newspaper called The Daily, and he forked out, you know, tens of millions of dollars subsidizing this. And he finally threw in the towel and said, I can't make any money, even with a monopoly here. And I think we have to face the cold truth, which is that journalism is a public good. It's never been supported commercially in the marketplace by final users, final readers, sufficiently to have a mass popular journalism. It was supported. We had the illusion that it was a commercial good, because the advertising provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues for the last century or so, and it was very profitable during that era. But the era is over now. Advertising no longer needs to attach itself to journalism. It no longer needs to give a big chunk of what it pays to out to media to produce content. And as a result of that, journalism, we see it again standing naked without that support. And if we're going to have journalism, we have to understand it as a public good. There's no magical recipe that some commercial genius is going to come up with. The hedge fund guys tried. They gave up. The reason Jeff Bezos bought this, not as part of the Amazon empire, but as a private investment, I think, indicates that, like the dude who bought the San Diego paper, Manchester,
right,
these are political investments. These are not commercial investments. These are pushing your political agenda and willing to pay a lot of money because you know you've got billions and tens of billions on the line if you win major fights.
So so is this a political agenda? I mean, that's the thing. Of course, we have Bezos saying it's not a political agenda. He was also quoted as saying that there will be no print newspapers in 20 years. There'll be luxury items in the hotels, and that's it. So he has said that. But is there a political agenda here with the people who are buying newspapers? One of the things we'll hear from with the David Simon clip. Well, let's pull that. Let's play the David Simon clip right now for a moment. Just lead into this piece. Go ahead.
When I heard that the Koch brothers, bless their hearts, were interested in purchasing newspapers, and the Baltimore Sun, my alma mater in particular, I thought, well, that's kind of the last nail in the coffin. There's a lot of damage that's been done to print journalism in the last 15 years, 20 years. Much of it's self-inflicted in the sense of the original sin for American journalism, for print journalism in particular, was going to Wall Street, was going to listen to analysts who told them, effectively, 20 years ago, you know, if you spend less money, if you reduce your staff, reduce your news hole, reduce your expenses, cover less, you can actually make more money. It was right in the short term. Wall Street's always right in the short term. But when I heard that the Koch brothers, being as ideological as they are, were now looking to buy the husk of these Tribune Company papers, I thought to myself, well, that's the end game. That's the end game. You know, it's not enough for you to lobby government. It's not enough for you to influence elections. Newspapers, the Fourth Estate, are supposed to be outside of that. You know, you can't have a great city without a great newspaper. They run together.
So picking up that on that piece, and Sherilyn Ifill, who's now head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, just tweeted the show saying, does it bother you that billionaires are purchasing newspapers? She said that it depends on that billionaires or which billionaires, is what she said.
So, I think there's something.
Look, there's
to
no
that
difference
question.
Between billionaires. They got a lot of money.
Yeah, but as I said before, having rich people own newspapers isn't a new thing. What is kind of an aberration, if you look at this historically, is having a press that claims to be independent of any ideology. For much of our history, journalistic organs, particularly newspapers, were known for a particular point of view. The more recent development was trying to have a news hole that was free of ideology. Trying is the operative word. While the editorial page might be seen as conservative or liberal, in some cases, midstream. But I'm not particularly bothered that rich people are owning papers if they own it with the sense that the Graham family seemed to have had with the Washington Post, that it was a public trust. I think to some extent the Sulzberger family still has that with the New York Times. It's not going to be their big moneymaker. They're going to hold it as a public trust. If that's the case, fine. If going to a billionaire to save the publication is what we have to do, fine.
Well, so let me do that. On the way to Karen Hoopert, let me go back to Bob for a minute and come right back to Karen Hoopert. So where is the rubber that meets the road? Where's the evidence that the billionaires who have bought these newspapers recently are changing the ideology of the papers, are pushing an ideology, are changing the way we're doing the news?
Well, it's obviously too early to say with a Bezos or John Henry. And, you know, I would say that, you know, the way organizational structures work in news media is very rarely that the owner marches in, smashes his fist on the table, and fires people and makes a ruckus if he doesn't get or she doesn't get the coverage they want. That happens extremely rarely. More often, it's that there's sort of a sort of culture that's built up, and people, successful journalists who stay there in advance, internalize the proper values, and those that aren't comfortable with it either leave voluntarily or just find they aren't getting promoted. And so that's really the way these things work, and that's actually how it worked even in old Soviet media. You know, the Pravda and Izvestia and TASS rarely had someone go in and beat up journalists and chain them to the wall and rough them up. People just internalized the values of what the commissars wanted, and those who were happy doing it and internalized it as proper rose to the very top. And, you know, I think that when Bezos, I mean, getting to him, because this is very important, I have good friends in Seattle who know Bezos, who work with him, and they, you know, they presented him to me as someone who was an extremely brilliant businessman who had absolutely zero social consciousness. You know, they tried to get him to do anything in the Seattle area, like the people at Microsoft do, and other business leaders, or Costco, or Nordstrom's, and he just really wasn't that interested. So I think the idea that he's doing this as a benevolent, good-hearted billionaire who cares about, you know, the future of the humanity, I mean, he's not the guy I would put simple casting would have picked for that role. He, in fact, is someone who does have very strong political agenda. You know, his company, Amazon, is deeply concerned with keeping wages low. He has a non-union workforce that's paid about half the wages of the average worker in their factories. He has a real agenda to minimize the power of organized labor. He doesn't pay many taxes. He doesn't like paying taxes like other businesses and rich people, but it's a big part of his business model. He's really concerned about that. He wants to be able to travel all over the world without any prohibition and have the U.S. government help him enter markets. That's a very important part of his growth model. So he's got a lot of issues that are important to him. He's involved. He's a monopoly. He's in huge, serious, continual antitrust litigation. He's been battling the book industry. He's been at war with that. He's going to be at war with virtually every retail industry he's trying to take over digitally. And he's screwing up his monopoly power. So he's got constant team of lawyers. It's probably one of the largest units at Amazon trying to keep him from being prosecuted or being broken up as a monopoly by the law. So he's got a lot of, you know, things that really are important to him that he lives and dies for. And it's hard not to believe that at some point this won't influence why he would buy a newspaper that, by all accounts, is losing a lot of money, and then no one on Wall Street thinks he'll ever be able to make money.
So we have time for another comment. We've got to go to break. Well, why don't you jump in here, Karen, and then we're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to go to Jeff, and Bruce.
Okay. Well, one of the things, you know, you were saying is that it's not – that he's not doing this out of any kind of social consciousness or as an altruistic move. I believe that. But I do think that – perhaps he finds this an intellectual challenge, that he might have taken this on because he thinks he can make money from this industry. And I think in some ways, because he comes out of this digital background, that it's a significant move. It's not just any millionaire. It's this millionaire who is coming with a different perspective in a way that even as we're sitting around here at the table talking about things, I notice, you know, you're saying like the newspaper, people in their 20s and 30s don't read the newspaper. But I think that really today that's a kind of false distinction to say the newspaper versus reading online. I mean, journalism is online right now. So the fact that people aren't reading it in print, who cares, right? We've moved to the digital world. Now, can he come in and make this model effective and work? I think that actually is kind of an interesting question, and that maybe his outsider perspective might bring some interesting changes to the media.
And his deep pockets.
And his deep pockets and his willingness to wait years and years and years until he turns a profit. That could be useful.
Let me go back. Let me take a break, then we'll go to the phones. 410-319-8888. Come back to the first Jeff who called in, then the second Jeff, then Bruce. Stay with us.
And I will always love you.
Welcome back. That was Whitney Houston, of course, born on this day, 1963. We're here with Robert McChesney, Karen Hooper, E.R. Shipp, Charles Robinson, talking about the future of journalism. We have emails coming in, one that's kind of funny. I'll read them. We'll go right to the phones. Peter Slavin wrote in, Steiner Show might go under if you couldn't draw on Morgan State faculty. At 9 a.m., two of his four guests are from Morgan. It must be more than the love of home cooking. Is Morgan trying to capitalize on this? So I like to read everything that comes in. That came in. So I'll just won't respond. I just want to throw it out there.
Go, Morgan.
I'm not from Morgan.
410, and neither is Bobby Chesney. 410-319-8888. Neither am I, really. Let's go to Jeff on line two. You're on the air.
I'm here.
Which Jeff? Okay, whatever you are. Whichever Jeff is, please go ahead.
I'm here.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, okay. All right. So in an informed electorate, I can't tell whether you can hear me or not.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. And democracy and money has already been discussed in Robert McChesney's books. I don't know if the other authors are writing about the same stuff, but and he's been so quiet this hour.
I don't think so. But anyway, go ahead.
Does any of you think our government is actually aiming at journalists? We have Michael Hastings dead. The Guardian, who's working with Snowden? I don't know if... I sort of feel like almost as though we're our government is taking aim at people like Snowden and Bradley Manning and the guy who's locked in the embassy in London and I can't come up with all of their names.
Oh, Julian Assange.
Julian Assange.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But the other thing is,
and Glenn Greenwald is the one who they've been attacking.
Glenn Greenwald.
Other
right.
folks at the Guardian.
Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, right.
But the point I'm trying to make is. Are two things for hopefully you all to talk about. Is our government actually aiming at these people and at what is supposed to give us an informed electorate? They're sort of aiming at universities and defunding research and real science. But also, how can we maybe bring in some decent people, hopefully Ben Cardin or some, you know, McCluskey, our senators.
McCluskey,
Our congressmen can actually, how can we actually bring some pressure to bear on supporting what should be public institutions, the press, or publicly funded anyway, because we don't want the Kochs running the Los Angeles Times. And the other thing I hope that you guys will bring to bear, you all to bear on, is... What happened with the Michael Hastings investigation by the FBI, and also where are the Kochs in buying the Los Angeles Times? These things just fall through the cracks. And what happened to the FBI shooting in Florida? That's dropped out of the...
Well, I don't know if we can tackle all those things.
I know, but
right, not today anyway. But I think that what you're raising is important, and I think that what we talked about during the break kind of fits into this. And I don't know if Bob McChesney, you heard what we were saying during the break, but... Part of that had to do with, if you put together what Jeff, our caller, was just talking about in terms of the attacks on journalists, one of the things that Jeff Bezos, as we talked about during break, that I brought up, was known for was his blocking WikiLeaks, was cooperating with the government in terms of giving information off of his sites. And so those kind of things give you a moment to pause. And the question is, how does this or does this not feed in to the whole issue of people worrying about, concerned about journalists being targeted for writing the things they write about, like the New York Times and the NSA, or the Guardian and Snowden?
Well, there are a couple points that, Mark, I'd make on this. First of all, you know, we've seen a real decline in the number of working journalists and the amount of resources going to journalism in the last generation. This really even predates the Internet. It started in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I've traveled to like 20 cities. I bet Baltimore is no different. And when I go to newsrooms and I talk to professors of journalism, I ask them to, in every city, you know, how many working journalists, paid journalists in any medium, broadcast, Internet, print, are there today compared to, say, 1985 or 1988? And depending on the city, the number is invariably radically lower, but anywhere from 50 to 70% lower than what it was 20, 25 years ago. Especially in some cities, it's even more striking. Some it's not as bad. But, you know, we just have a lot less journalists. And as a result of that, I think that the fear that journalism once had in people in power has diminished. I think that governments, people in power, no longer take journalism seriously, news media seriously, so they feel less compunction, they're less concerned about treating them poorly than they would have been in the past, and there was a lot more fear of them. And that's the real problem when you lose the Fourth Estate, and that's what's happening right now in the United States. Now, the second point, and you talked about this during the break, I missed it. I think you're absolutely right. Jeff Bezos, you know, Amazon just signed a deal with their cloud server, and that's one of their big services, is offering cloud services. The whole Obama campaign ran on Amazon's clouds for 2012 re-election, and they just signed either a $500 or $600 million deal with the CIA to handle CIA material on their cloud. Jeff Bezos and Amazon are, you know, closely linked to power in this country. And can you have an independent news media when you've got the person owning your second or third most important paper in the country so closely linked financially to the military-industrial complex? You know, I'll just conclude with this. I had an interview with the Russian media about this very issue, and I said, look, in Russia, you know, if Russia had some billionaire who was closely linked to the government and the military and the KGB in Russia today and the spying apparatus and making a fortune off it by the dominant newspaper in Moscow, Americans, John McCain's head would explode. Americans are going bananas. And, you know, they look at Jeff Bezos and Washington Post and wonder, why aren't we going bananas?
Let me talk a little bit about the attacks on whether or not journalists are under attack, being a working journalist. You know, if you're working in the investigative world, it's always been a tough world. In other words, you've got to get people to confide in you. And, you know, journalists have gone to jail behind this idea of not turning over sources. The fact that the NSA and others are, you know, monitoring phone calls of journalists, you know, abhors me. But guess what? It's the trade-off that you have to make. In other words, you know, I think today is like one of the anniversaries of Watergate, which was that seminal moment in journalism where, you know, confidentiality literally lasted for multiple years. You know, these days, that's not happening.
So what are you saying? It's acceptable?
It's not acceptable. But, you know, it's part, if you're an investigative journalist, and especially if you're on what we call the hot story, the story that nobody wants you to learn about, you know, you're going to get heat.
Yeah, but we're not going to get heat, but that sounds like you're justifying
it. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that that's a part of the job, that someone's going to say, I need to find out who that person is talking to. Think about the number of years that Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward would not reveal who Deep Throat was. I mean, come on. It was over 20-plus years. And remember, their rule was...
But the difference is that Bob Woodward was not... These guys were not pushed to the point of having a fear that they were going to be put in jail and prosecuted for the stories they
did. Trust me, Nixon had his enemies list.
But they weren't prosecuted. They weren't pushed to the point of prosecution, which is where we find ourselves today.
Right. And I'm not saying... But that's... You will always get the pushback. In other words... Somebody doesn't want you to know. Right now, there are hundreds of Freedom of Information Acts that government officials from both state and national level will kind of stymie you by walking you through a ton of paperwork just to get little bits of information. And then when you find it, you know, you want to confirm it because you don't want to just be out there hanging. But I want people to understand that that's a part of the job.
And I guess I just don't agree that it's a part of the job, but it's also – not something that we put up with because of the First Amendment. It shouldn't be. It's not part of the job.
I don't think we should put up with it.
It's like if your part of the job is being a policeman, your part of the job is maybe you might get shot. Doesn't mean you put up with getting shot.
Right.
Well, I'm not right. In a slightly different direction, you mentioned Watergate. That was something ultimately that was a highlight in journalism in the 20th century. But the key thing there was that the owners of the newspaper supported the efforts of the journalists to get that story.
No matter what
the government was doing, the owners then, the Graham family, supported the reporters. The question we have now is to what extent this new crop of owners will go to bat on those stories, those same kinds of stories. And even on a, a, or a more simple question in Boston, the new owner, John Henry, was very critical of Boston Globe coverage of the Boston Red Sox, which he also owns. So they're wondering whether the Boston Globe, under his leadership, will now have to pull back on even questioning baseball team. So those are the kinds of questions that we have. It's not so much, as someone said, that rich people are owning media. It's which ones are owning and what their goal is.
That's what Sherilyn Eiffel tweeted in.
What the end game is.
Mm-hmm. Karen, a thought before we go back to the phones?
Well, I was just thinking, too, about this idea of, the need for journalism to be publicly funded, too, which isn't, that model is tried and gets floated and whatever. And one of the things I think to keep in mind with that, too, is does that then increase the government's ability to censor or go after journalists who are critical, or does it decrease? I mean, I think that you have to kind of think really carefully through that and look at other, countries, too, where that is the model, because that can be worrisome, too.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because here's an email that came in that kind of focused on that, from Jay Clark, who writes in, "It seems that Europe's newspapers are not as beleaguered as the United States. What are they doing? Why are their papers still in demand?" Bob, do you have a response to that?
Well, I think every country in the world is facing this sort of existential crisis for journalism as a commercial undertaking. But it's not as severe in some places of the world, especially Northern Europe. I just came back from Scandinavia, and I'm about to return there. I'm doing some research. And the two reasons why, and they're the first admitted, is they have policies there, subsidies to keep alive multiple newspapers and communities, government subsidies on one hand, so there'd be multiple voices. And secondly, they spend a fortune by American standards in all these countries on public media and community media. So there are working journalists in small towns even, that are supported by their national public broadcasting system, which do journalism. So they keep it. There's a lot of journalism going on. And if you took away the government support, the public support, they'd be pretty close to the American boat. I think that – so that's the key difference. And I think that points clearly to the sort of solution we've got to be talking about, which ironically, as you know, Mark, from my book,
yeah,
is the American tradition, the first 100 years of American history. Why we had a great abolitionist book, why we had such a wonderful print media, wasn't because of the marketplace. The marketplace had no interest in that. It was because we had massive postal and printing subsidies that made it very inexpensive for people to start newspapers.
See, and that's the point. I mean, is this where the divide happens over ownership and over the question of how the role of our economic system, capitalism, plays into this in terms of ownership versus the public responsibility in terms of keeping a free press? We already see the attack on public media, mm-hmm, whether it's public radio stations like this or public TV, mm-hmm, where Charles works. That is a piece of this, and I think, well, let me just stop there.
Well, it is. I go back to what I said before. We have to think of journalism as part of this public trust. So to what extent do we go to support it? Do we rely solely on benevolent billionaires, or is there some role for government, making it possible to mail newspapers at an inexpensive rate was very important early on in our history. So the government did have a role. What is that role now? As Karen was saying, I'm a bit nervous to think that we'd have Congress voting on a budget for media every year, because they would obviously want to support media that is not too critical of them. So are we going to turn ourselves over to a congressional oversight board? I don't think that's any better than having the stockbrokers or the shareholders of a newspaper controlling what we have. I don't know what the answer is. But I think that ultimately we have to think of journalism as a public trust, and we have to do what it takes to promote that.
On the way back to the phones, Karen, do you want to jump in on this real fast?
Yeah, I was just saying, just thinking that it was, it's also, I think, a time in which not just sort of the model, the financial model for newspapers is shifting, but also the content is shifting in significant ways. And there's been a big shakeup, I think, in all of that. And, you know, I think that ultimately what will happen is that readers will realize they're looking for a curated experience when they read the paper, and that they will come to value what journalists and newspapers, although I call them newspapers, I mean media, bring
whatever
to them.
Whatever form that takes. That
whatever form. And that eventually they'll recognize that that's a value to them, and good journalism and good editors and good stories are important.
Well, there are two things I want to get to. I get to a phone call here, but there's an issue of what that public responsibility is in the 21st century form, Bob, that you mentioned the 19th century form of. And if we can get to it, we can get to it maybe another day, is the role of what happened because of segregation and slavery of the powerful African-American press between the 1840s and 1970s. And what does that say about the 21st century world, and how that people of color, communities of color, have an effect and impact on the press of this century? But let's go first quick call. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad I was waiting. I was going to come up with one tack, but I'm going to go with a different one because of what Jeff said about an informed public. Thomas Jefferson talked about that over two centuries ago, how important it is for a democracy, for citizens to participate as voters, participate in the system, to be informed. So if you go with that, you have to understand that there should be newspapers should be neutral, but they're not. They all come from an ideological stance. The Sun papers does, not just on opinion pages, it's the way you frame a story. It's what, it's how long the column is. It's the way you edit it. It's what page it's on. The Sun papers has had a very liberal ideological political stance, so they want to influence government, want to influence the legislature. Fine, they're allowed to do that. That's perfectly reasonable. I may not agree with what they're saying, but you're saying, well, wait a minute. We're not going to allow a conservative person to buy a newspaper or to put out an ideological point of view to influence the legislature or influence social views or what you always talk about, race. So I buy the Sun papers every morning and the Washington Times, and I read them both. Obviously, the Sun papers is considerably more liberal. Obviously, the Washington Times is conservative. But I listen to both sides of the story. And I'm going to say this. The Washington Times is a much better newspaper, not just because I agree with some of their points of view. Not all of them. I don't walk lockstep with the conservatives. Let me tell you. So the point is, it's a better newspaper because it's a better layout, better graphics, better artistic
okay.
value. And to a certain extent, they do international stories. They're more thorough. It's better writing. It's done much better. They do.
Okay, Bruce.
They have more time to story than the Sun papers do.
Bruce, I got it. And so I appreciate that. I think that they're on the editorial page of the Sun. They are more liberal and conservative. Clearly, same thing with the Times. Though I'd say the three out of five of the major columnists for the Sun are now conservative, not liberal, which is an interesting shift that they've made as well. And Suni writes in, look at the media situation in the Middle East, where growth has spurred increasing partnership, blurring the line between news and propaganda, which is some of the criticism we're seeing today about Al Jazeera and their reporting and more. But, Bob, let me ask you to comment something so we can throw out here at the end, which is things that you commented on and that Shipp commented on just a moment ago. So what is the 21st century model then? I'm not going to go back to the postal model of the 19th century. So how does that play out in the 21st century?
Well, I think we have to, you know, we've talked about journalism as a public trust. I think a better term is public good. It's something the market can't produce in sufficient quality or quantity, but the society desperately needs. And what that means is that there's no way even citizens who want journalism can use the marketplace to get what they want. It's like public education or fire departments or police or military. It's something that has to be done collectively through public funding. That doesn't mean there can't be huge private sector involvement, but it's driven by public funding, or it doesn't happen, like education. And I think if we look at the countries, the most democratic countries in the world, by The Economist magazine or virtually all standards, the U.S. usually ranks pretty far down the list now. You look at the top 5 or 10 countries, and they're all countries that spend an enormous amount of money on public media and journalism. And these are public media and journalism systems quite unlike what we've been talking about in the show, that aren't like stool pigeon systems like you'd find in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany or some banana republic. In fact, what the research shows is the more these countries spend on media, the more diverse and adversarial these news media are toward their government and the more democratic society. You know, this is a problem we solved the first century of American history with postal subsidies, which were brilliant, and gave us the African-American press and the abolitionist press. And we can solve again. It's a solvable problem, but we've just got to start thinking about it in terms of being a public good and stop praying that there's going to be a commercial model when it's obvious and they're obviously never going to happen.
I just think the 21st century model of what journalism is a device that delivers the material to you wherever you want it, however you want it, and it is smaller and it is shorter in length. If you want that breadth and depth of coverage, there will be places that you will go. But the average individual will want it, I hate to say it, quick, fast, and hurry.
Yeah, but let me just interrupt you, though. Chip,
but who's going to support that?
Right. And a question I have is what you just said, Chip, is if – let's say that may be true in some ways about where it's going, but the difference is there's a disconnect between the kind of investigative journalism that has made the kind of rights, whether it's civil rights or labor rights or looking at the environment or what the intelligence agencies are doing. Those have been long investigative pieces. Everybody might not have read them, but they had an effect on policy and creating stuff. And if we go to nothing but these short digital pieces, which is where people like Bezos might want to take us, that to me is a danger of the future of journalism.
That is something that we should be concerned about. Even those short little pieces that people are flocking to are generally condensed versions in many ways of those longer pieces that have been supported in other media.
Right.
So I don't want to just say that if people want longer pieces, they have somewhere to go. Well, who's going to support that somewhere to go part? So that's what we're focusing on now is if the Washington Post or the New York Times are at the mercy of their corporate owners at some point and cannot explore these topics, then we're in trouble. The entertainment and the short features and all of that that people like that are readily accessible through digital media will not be enough to sustain this informed public that we want. So I think we need to find ways to support serious journalism, even as people are gravitating towards the lighter.
The short and sweet.
The aggregated model or whatever. And the other thing with that, too, that I think is really interesting, too, I mean, on the plus side is in terms of democracy or promoting democracy is the way that people read news on the Internet, too, is you jump around. So you're actually getting, in some ways, sometimes, arguably, a richer experience because you're reading – you read one article, you link to another who has an opposing point of view, you link to another one, you go to the primary source, you say, really, is that really what the whole letter, is that really how it read? What was the context of the statement? Da, 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 da. You know, so the potential is there to be a better model for democracy and debate if this issue of serious journalism can be funded in like the ProPublica model or one of those sorts of models. So I think it's not all bad. I think there's a lot of potential for lively debate.
And people such as your caller who said he reads the Washington Times and the Baltimore Sun, those kind of people will find ample opportunities in digital media to do just that. But somehow, though, we still have to finance the main sources of that news in the first place. We can't just rely upon websites that currently just republish.
Aggregate.
So we have a minute left. I wish we had more. People are just calling in. Michael, I'm sorry we can't get to your call. But Bob, a final thought on the way out the door. We have about a minute left.
Well, I would just say, you know, we're in a situation now, unless there's some public policy change, where we're probably going to see what's happened this week in Boston and Washington take place around the country, because the rational thing now is for these monopoly newspapers, which still have considerable influence, even if they have shrinking newsrooms, to be bought up by people, not for commercial reasons, but to push political agendas, and have monopoly power in their communities to do so. I don't think that it's hard, you know, I don't think we're reduced to basically rooting that we get a good billionaire who's going to be benevolent and friendly, a Casper the Ghost billionaire. I think it's a pretty sad and pathetic state of affairs for American democracy. I think the framers of this country would never stop throwing up if they saw it.
Well, I think that we need to come back to this discussion. It's been a really lively discussion. It's caused a lot of debate in our community by email, by tweet, by phone call, people we could not get to. And I think it's really critical for our future, and also given, despite what our caller said, our emailer said, that with Morgan State University and now having the only school of journalism in the city of Baltimore and in this area, it's important to continue this and make this a conversation to carry out. And I want to thank our guest, Bob McChesney, author of The Digital Disconnect, as well as his latest book, Dollarocracy, who's coming to Baltimore September 17th. You should be there with all of us, Karen Hoopert and E.R. Shipp here from Morgan State University's School of Journalism, Global School of Journalism, I should say, and Charles Robinson from Maryland Public Television. Good to have the four of you with us.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Walter Jones, who has written this book called March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights, looking at the role that labor movements, and specifically black labor movements, played in the formation of that march and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Well, no one told me just how to get there. But when I get there, I know. 'Cause I'm taking it step by step.